Chaos is a Greek word. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Greece enters uncharted waters after rejecting more of Europe's austerity measures. The fact is, the country's broke, and many Greeks have known it for some time now.
We were living on money that we had borrowed from others. And at some time, this money ran out.
What's next for Greece and the European Union just ahead? Plus, the U.S. wins big at the Women's World Cup, and it might just change the way everyone thinks about women's soccer.
I'm really encouraged to see people enjoying the sport for what it is. And I was like, hey, look, there's a bunch of girls playing soccer. Isn't that cool? Now it's like, wow, the U.S. women's team is good.
Yeah, I'll say. Those stories and more coming up today here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. So, now what? Millions of Greek voters said no yesterday to more austerity. In other words, they rejected the terms of a proposed bailout designed to keep their country from financial collapse, which in theory puts Greece on the road to both bankruptcy and an exit from the eurozone. Although it seems the Greek government is not giving up yet on negotiating a new debt deal with its creditors, which are mostly in Germany. We're going to get the view from Germany in a moment, but we begin at the epicenter of this financial crisis, Greece itself. Reporter Christos Michalidis is in Athens. He says Greek voters now face an uncertain future.
They're very, very anxious. They're very worried. And there was a bit of optimism today, a bit of hope, let's say, knowing that at the same time, from 10 o'clock in the morning, all the political leaders of the democratic parties in parliament at last decided to come together and try and get together so that they could agree on what sort of proposals the prime minister will hand over to the European partners tomorrow in Brussels. So there was some hope amongst the people that at least if we all go together and if the Europeans are persuaded that this time it's not just one party that wants the solution, but that this is actually backed by the majority of the Greek parliament, which could be a sort of guarantee for the European partners and lenders, then maybe an agreement could be very, very close. That's what the people are hoping here.
I mean, Europe might look at that consensus and say, well, the vote in Greece was 60% no, 40% yes. I want to ask you about that. A lot of people supporting the no side were young, facing a 50% unemployment rate. What do you make of that demographic split?
I have the feeling deep inside me that the majority of those who voted no yesterday, and this might seem almost absurd, voted no because they want to stay within the European Union and they want to get a message. Many of the people, I believe most of the people who voted no, did that, placing their bets on the strongest horse, on the politician that they felt is stronger at this time than all the rest of the others, to actually go to Brussels and say, listen, I come here with a mandate not to fight, but with a mandate to agree, to keep Greece within the European Union and the euro. Within themselves, deep inside, everybody here knows they do belong to the European continent geographically and to the European Union in terms of what is best for the country. So I interpret they voted no, meaning that they want an agreement. Now, this makes the European partners even more angry because, first of all, they're saying the Greeks are crazy. They don't know what they want. And on the other hand, they seem to have lost their trust in the political establishment here.
You know, it's really interesting speaking with you, Christos, over the last couple of weeks. Each progressive time, it seems you're getting more and more frustrated and speaking less as a journalist and more as a Greek who's just really at the end of his rope.
it's most probably one of the few times in my life as a journalist that I've crossed the line. I'm not standing out of the queue just watching people going to withdraw the money. I'm also standing in the queue myself. I just have the extra luxury of being able to talk to a lot of people directly, to pick up my phone and actually speak with politicians. And then I get the real insight to the story. And I also begin to understand we are in a mess, spending much more money than we could actually afford. We were living on money that we had borrowed from others. And at some time, this money ran out and people started asking for their money back. And so we began getting frustrated. And we believed that we could get away with it relatively easily. So this is the situation now. There is an effort. Six political leaders got together and agreed to support the one government that they have. Now, if this is going to work out and if they're going to get a better agreement with the lenders, I really don't know. They'll have to do a lot of work to persuade the Europeans to accept this agreement.
That was reporter Christos Michalidis speaking with me from Athens. Now let's hear about reaction in Germany, whose banks are the most exposed to Greek debt. Eric Jaruzinski is a writer and former professor of German, as in the language. He runs the hugely popular Twitter account, Nine Quarterly. That's N-E-I-N, the German word for no. Jaruzinski was in Athens last week, but today he's in Berlin. He says Germans are mostly confused by the news from Greece.
There's certainly a sense that Greece is in what is for Germany perhaps an unthinkable position. The referendum vote was being compared to a type of suicide. Today, one of Germany's main newspapers, their headline was simply addressed to Angela Merkel, "What's next?"
The no vote in Greece was approximately 60% to 40% for the yes. So if we just go by the gauge of German politicians today, how are they responding?
There's been a bit of weighing what this means, because on the one hand, there's a commitment to keeping Europe together, and there's concern about a legacy. In fact, this week, the cover of Der Spiegel, the leading German news magazine, has a picture of Angela Merkel sitting among the ruins of Europe. And the question is, would this be her legacy if, in fact, things fall apart for the Euro or for the European Union somehow? And so I think there's been a lot of caution on the one hand. On the other, leading up to the vote, the tone of discussion has become less and less diplomatic. I'm an outsider. I know German culture pretty well, but I'm from the U.S. And for me, it's interesting just to see ways in which very old national stereotypes and various cliches have come to bear on both sides pretty strongly.
Give me an example of those stereotypes and kind of cliches, at least among Germans that you know of, that seem to be kind of emerging.
Well, I think the thing that you see a lot of has to do with the Greeks being irrational. And I think that there's a question about whether or not this is fair, that essentially Greece should somehow get off the hook, sort of a moral sense as well, in terms of one pays back what one owes, that you don't simply walk away from one's responsibility.
Now, there's a German comedian named Dieter Nuhr who recently tweeted that his own family had completed a democratic vote themselves and decided not to pay their mortgage. Kind of funny. Is that a widespread attitude, though, among Germans right now, that this Greek decision is kind of ridiculous?
I think so, in a way, yes. It just doesn't seem to add up or to make sense to people that you should have debts and not pay them. Today, a lot of the reports have simply been adding up the amount of money that's gone into Greece over the last 5-10 years and asking that question of where is our money gone and how much more money is this going to cost?
Well, a number of people, including economist Jeffrey Sachs, have pointed out that Germany itself had huge debts forgiven in the wake of World War II, and even Greece was part of a group of countries that forgave Germany's debt. Are politicians in Germany responding at all to that criticism?
Definitely. And there's no one single German position here either. There have been solidarity marches in Germany in the last couple of days. Primarily, it's the German left that's been supportive of the no vote in Greece. There's been a reaction, which is we want to help Greece, but they have to play by the rules.
Quick question, Eric. You teach German, so what things have you been reading that non-German speakers wouldn't pick up on?
Well, I mean, one thing that was interesting was when Tsipras first visited Berlin some time ago, one of Germany's leading daily newspapers, which is more of a tabloid, the Bild-Zeitung, greeted him with an enormous headline, which simply was "Nein." And at that point, "Nein" meant no to any further financial assistance. no to those greedy Greeks was in fact the language that was being used there.
Wow. One wonders if the Greeks just threw the no back at Germany out of spite.
I actually think that's a pretty reasonable conclusion. I mean, there's a lot of anger in Greece at how they've been depicted. There are divisions within Europe that have been there for some time, but have very much come to the surface as a result of a crisis like this.
Eric Jarosinski, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
So we've heard today that Greece has really wanted to stick it to the European Union, but we've also heard that Greece really wants to stay in the EU at the same time. If there's one person who seems to epitomize this schizophrenia, it's a man who's just resigned as the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. The World's Clark Boyd covered the Greek economic crisis for a couple of years. He's also interviewed Varoufakis a few times. So Varoufakis, as I understand it, Clark, is a man who gets mobbed like a rock star by ordinary Greeks, or was mobbed like a rock star until he drove off on his big black motorcycle today. Why did he quit?
Well, Marco, there's lots of speculation running around as to why he quit. Of course, he was the guy who was kind of at the center of these ongoing negotiations between Greece and its Eurozone partners. And I think that there was this sense that the Eurozone partners had kind of tired of him. That might be putting it a little diplomatically. So let me let German politician Michael Fuchs say it perhaps a little bit more strongly.
Yanis Varoufakis insulted the whole of Europe last weekend, telling us we are terrorists. I mean, we spend more than 300 billion euros for Greece, and then telling them, you are terrorists, I'm sorry, this is not the way to talk to each other.
Right, so we have heard how he is a polarizing figure, Yanis Varoufakis, but that rhetoric, that fiery rhetoric made him really popular with ordinary Greeks, right?
Well, of course it did, Marco. I mean, ordinary Greeks said, this is the one guy who's standing up for us. He's going in front of these Europeans and telling it like it is. We can't take any more austerity. We can't tighten our belts anymore. You know, we want to stay in the European Union. We want to be a part of this European project, but we simply can't take it anymore. And you're going to have to find a way to lighten the load on us so that we can live our lives.
You've met him a few times one-on-one. What is he like? What's his personal style?
Oh, he's an interesting figure, Marco. I have to say that. I mean, he just exudes a lot of confidence. You know, when I talked to him, he wasn't finance minister yet. He was, as he called it, a lowly economist working at the University of Athens. But he always had very much a flair for the dramatic. He had amazing turns of phrase that managed to sort of go highbrow and lowbrow at the same time. He said that the European Union was like being in Hotel California. You can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave. And one time when I interviewed him, I asked him, as the European Union is dealing with the Greek economic crisis, how do you see that? What's that like? And here was his response.
It's a bit like the Titanic having hit the iceberg. It's leaking water everywhere, and the captain and his officers debating the efficiency of its engines.
Okay, really making the connections with culture all over the place, Hotel California and the Titanic. So
right.
Varoufakis says he's going to wear the creditor's loathing with pride. What is he going to do with his life now?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Marco. Here's a guy who was educated outside of Greece, whose English is flawless, who's taught in the UK, in Australia, in Belgium. For a while, before he became finance minister in Greece, he took a job with a video game company here in the United States looking at virtual currencies. So his interests are really broad. They're really wide. It's hard to say where he's going to end up, but I don't think we're going to see him as a part of Greek politics for a while now. I think he managed to make a lot of people in Europe very angry. And I think his boss, Alexis Tsipras, the leader of the Syriza party there in Greece, basically came to the realization, look, I know we voted no to the more austerity measures, but the country's bankrupt. We have to go and we have to get money somewhere. The only place we can go really is to Europe right now. And if Varoufakis is standing in the way, then he's got to go.
The World's Clark Boyd, thanks for explaining this to us and giving us a little portrait of Yanis Varoufakis.
You're welcome, Marco.
For women's soccer, 1991 was the moment, then 1999 was the moment. Okay, maybe 2015 really is the moment. We'll talk about what that moment is later here on The World.
Support for The World comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Pope Francis is in Ecuador today, the first part of a South American tour that also includes Bolivia and Paraguay. He's been warmly welcomed by Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa. In a speech today, Correa echoed the Pope's call to reduce income inequality. The president also took the opportunity to emphasize his commitment to protect human life from the moment of conception. You see, abortion is illegal in Ecuador, and many advocates for women there say they're losing ground because of Correa's religious views. Roxandra Guidi has our story from Quito.
Rafael Correa has a state TV and radio show that goes on for up to 4 hours on Saturday mornings. His Sabatina, it's called. Wearing a casual white polo shirt and with mic in hand, he'll speak live to an audience as his charming and populist self. He tackles just about any topic, from the status of infrastructure projects to social programs and tax reform plans. But for the past few years, his Sabatinas are also the space where he gets to broadcast his often controversial views on women. Correa says, everyone is free to choose in our society. A man can be effeminate and a woman can be manly. But I prefer a woman that looks like a woman, and I think a woman likes a man who looks like a man. Beware of these so-called fundamentalist feminist movements that want men and women to be the same. Women's groups in Ecuador say they've been losing a series of hard-won rights since Correa came into office in 2007. Most recently, they've seen the dissolution of the government agency tasked with reducing teen pregnancy. Correa reorganized it and appointed an anti-abortion activist to run it. Monica Hernandez is associated with the conservative Opus Dei organization, also a vocal proponent of abstinence. Here's Hernandez this past March, responding to criticism about the government's new Plan Familia, a parent education program pushing for abstinence.
This has nothing to do with religion. We want everyone in Ecuador to have a right to define their family planning according to their own beliefs.
The debate over family planning heated up in 2008 when Ecuador passed a new constitution. It says the state recognizes and guarantees life from the moment of conception. Then, last year, pressure from public health and gender rights activists led various assembly women to suggest a reform to the abortion law. Speaking to the media before the vote, President Correa dismissed the effort as, quote, a gay and abortionist agenda. Correa says, these days you'd think that saying you're a heterosexual who believes in family and in the church is a sin. I won't be ashamed for being a heterosexual male who believes in family and in the Catholic Church. But that's the discourse we hear from protesters, which, by the way, isn't shared by the majority of Ecuadorians. As it turns out, the latest national survey from 2014 finds that about 65% of Ecuadorians support decriminalizing abortion. On the other hand, more than 75% of Ecuadorians self-identify as Catholic, a majority of which is against terminating a pregnancy. Last year, 29,000 teenage girls gave birth in Ecuador. Teen pregnancy rates are so high here that the topic is a common one for radionovelas like this one, meant to bring sex education to the masses in an honest and straightforward way. Something that's missing in the government's new family planning program, which advocates for abstinence until marriage. The person behind these PSAs is José Ignacio López Vigil. He's a former Jesuit priest turned radio host who's now critical of the power of the religious lobby on the state by groups such as Opus Dei.
If you're a public official, you must respect secular public policies. But in Ecuador, public officials here still talk of the Bible and the crucifix. This is due to the influence of secret and very powerful Catholic sects that are wielding more and more influence on the Ecuadorian government.
López Vigil is referring to Opus Dei and other groups such as Tradición, Familia y Propiedad, which are linked to right-wing parties and or causes throughout Latin America. All support a strong abstinence-only message for sex ed. Birth control is hard to come by in Ecuador. Gynecologist Virginia Gomez de la Torre says that those who are most affected by an abstinence-only message are young, poor, and indigenous women.
Las mujeres que toman un anticonceptivo.
She says, if women had access to birth control, they wouldn't get pregnant. And if they weren't getting pregnant, they wouldn't need to have abortions. But there are many challenges to getting access to reproductive rights in this country. 25-year-old Veronica Vera is sitting at an outdoor cafe in downtown Quito. She's a leader with Salud Mujeres, a collective of young women who advocate for legal abortion. The people seated in the nearby tables are staring at Vera as she speaks. Saying the word aborto in public is something of a taboo here. But Vera thinks her group has made great strides on the debate over reproductive rights. People are more accepting of it, she says. And Salud Mujeres now runs a hotline to make misoprostol, a pill that induces abortions, more accessible. Through the hotline, Salud Mujeres helps women find the pill and guides them through the process of terminating their own pregnancies in a safe manner.
La opinión pública de aquí, desde que empezamos esta lucha, por ejemplo, con la línea.
Vera says, since we started the fight 6 years ago with our abortion hotline, public opinion has really shifted. I think people in Ecuador are more willing to listen to other arguments regarding abortion beyond the religious one. Still, when asked whether her activism for women's rights has changed her views of Catholicism or the Pope, Vera stops for a moment. No, she replies simply, off mic. Just because we support abortion doesn't mean many of us aren't people of faith. For The World, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, Ecuador.
Let's stay in Latin America for another minute or so.
Voy por la calle bajo mis pies. Toda la historia era una vez.
Dominique Pinto is the name of the singer and cellist. She goes by her stage name Dom La Nena. She's from Brazil, but she studied music in France and Argentina, so she's comfortable in many places and in several languages.
No pensando en vos, en una esquina, oigo tu voz.
Dom La Nena has a girlish voice, and La Nena does mean little girl. She got the stage name before she had a stage, simply due to all the older musicians she was always around. So the 25-year-old works that side of her identity. But with a sound like this, Dom La Nena can realistically continue being the little girl as long as that voice holds out. News headlines are next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some Texas activists want to ban Muslim Sharia law.
I do not want it used in our courts against any women.
But others in Texas think a ban would send the wrong message.
The spirit of it is anti-Muslim.
Sharia in the Lone Star State, that's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The next presidential election is more than a year away, but campaign season is already upon us. And that means, among other things, that U.S. immigration policy is again up for debate. And not just because of Donald Trump's recent comments. Last week in San Francisco, for example, an undocumented immigrant shot and killed a 32-year-old woman. That got a lot of people talking about the fact that San Francisco, like many cities in the U.S., is a sanctuary city for immigrants. Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, is here to help explain what does that mean, actually, for a city to be a sanctuary city.
Yeah, for a city to be a sanctuary city, it essentially means that no municipal funds or resources are used on trying to help federal law enforcement with immigration. So it means that local police agencies don't ask people about their immigration status. It means that local law enforcement agencies don't report federal immigration status to authorities. And about 140 cities across the nation are so-called sanctuary cities.
Tell us about this recent case in San Francisco. Who was arrested and what does it tell us?
45-year-old Francisco Sanchez was arrested for killing this young woman, 32 years old, walking in the Embarcadero in San Francisco with her father, was killed in broad daylight. It seems to be a heinous, tragic, terrible, random crime. And Mr. Sanchez is kind of the poster child, unfortunately, for talking about immigration policy. And I think that this is an example of bad facts could make bad policy.
So tell us why you think it's not a good thing that he's become the poster child for immigration policy.
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is that people tend to think that undocumented workers commit more crimes than people who are legal immigrants or who were born here. And the majority of the studies that I've seen just don't bear that out. And undocumented workers don't commit more crimes than other groups. And the crimes that they do commit tend to be based on, obviously, immigration status, but also traffic violations. So much more lower level crimes. And unfortunately, this incident has, I think, sparked the national attention because Donald Trump had this erroneous, pretty ridiculous comment that, well, everybody that's being sent from Mexico, that they're doing all the raping and they're committing all the crimes. That's simply not the case. But what we have here is an undocumented worker who committed a heinous crime.
Mr. Sanchez, not only undocumented, but he had been deported back to Mexico five times. So doesn't this case tell us something about current immigration policy that maybe it's dysfunctional in some ways?
Absolutely. I think that Mr. Sanchez is an example of failed immigration policy. He was deported five times and it, you know, clearly didn't take. And so we have a problem that seems separate and apart from the sanctuary city issue. Now, there is an issue that I think that San Francisco will have to very specifically address, which is that Mr. Sanchez was recently arrested for a lower level crime. ICE had asked San Francisco to basically make them aware of what they were doing with him. And San Francisco released him on this lower level charge. I believe it was a marijuana possession charge, and did not let immigration authorities know. Now, my understanding is that it's San Francisco's policy that they don't alert federal authorities unless there's a pending felony. Now, there wasn't a pending felony in this case, but there were prior felonies. So this is a good time for San Francisco to look at their policy and maybe evaluate if this is a situation where they should work with federal immigration authorities, regardless of the fact that they're a sanctuary city.
Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember Lord of the Flies? Prep school boys from England end up stranded on a tropical island, and then, in the absence of grown-ups watching them, the kids regress to a violent, primitive state. A judge in California recently referred to William Golding's novel to describe the behavior of a group of teenagers in the L.A. suburb of Roland Heights. These kids are charged with torture, kidnapping, and assault on a fellow student. All of them are from China, and they are all known as parachute kids. That is, they're sent to live in the U.S. alone, without parents or other adult family members. Cindy Chang of the L.A. Times has been reporting on what happened between these teenagers. Cindy, thanks for joining us. Can you just start by telling us about this incident in March?
You know, to some extent, it was just a sort of a normal high school conflict with a bit of bullying involved, ganging up on this one girl. But the details are pretty horrific. They started out at an ice cream shop, and they made her kneel down and wipe the floor with her hands. And then they took her to a park, and while people were playing basketball nearby, they slapped her. They kicked her in the head with high heels. They made her strip naked. They took photos of her. And the worst part was they burned her with cigarettes, including on her nipples.
Why did they do that?
It's a bit difficult to understand. Purely from the court record, the only reference is to a dispute over a dinner bill. One of the attorneys told me it also had to do with a boy and with some social media posts that the victim may have made disparaging one of the other girls' hometown.
And these are teenage kids?
They're high school age. So they're sent here by their parents to study, you know, high school in the U.S. with hopes of getting into a U.S. college, but the parents didn't come along with them, and they stay in private homes that are kind of like boarding houses.
So these parachute kids, you said their families send them to the United States from China. Are they from wealthy families?
Some of them are. Supposedly, these kids were not that wealthy, but more of maybe an aspirational middle class. And the school that some of them went to, called Oxford School, charges like $13,000 a year in tuition plus the room and board that the kids are paying. But if you go to the school, I mean, you don't get the feeling that it's worth $13,000. It's just at the back of a strip mall, a few portable classrooms, this kind of run-down little rec area with parched grass and just like a soccer goal is pretty much it.
How many of these so-called parachute kids are in California?
I mean, it's hard to say exactly how many parachute kids, but we do know that the number of international high school students has really grown exponentially, with about 9,000 some in California who are from China.
What's been the response to this case in China right now?
It's been talked about a lot. I mean, you know, as kind of a cautionary tale that maybe you should think twice before sending young kids so far away. And it's also been analyzed in terms of how the legal system has dealt with the case. In China, the tendency is to settle this type of matter internally through the school and the parents. And there's actually been a wrinkle in this case where the father of one of the juveniles who is involved allegedly offered money to the victims to make the case go away, and he was actually arrested.
What will happen to these kids now?
Well, there's three who are in adult court, and actually one of them is a boy, and the charges are very serious. One of them includes torture, which carries a life sentence. Their bail was set at $3 million, so they've been behind bars ever since this happened.
The perception is that many kids in China see the U.S. and its schools as the golden chalice, and they do all the right things if they can. They fill in all the blanks, and they stay on the straight and narrow to get into these top-notch schools here. But this story really shows another side of Chinese students. Did it surprise you? Is it surprising a lot of people?
It's not too surprising to people who know the history of parachute kids. There's been a resurgence of that phenomenon lately, but actually, back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of kids from Taiwan who were being sent here under similar circumstances. Although they would tend to live either with an aunt and uncle, or sometimes the parents who were rich would buy them a house in, you know, a nice suburban area, and the kids would just stay there by themselves. And we saw back then some of the issues where, again, some kids did fine and others got involved in gangs and things like that.
Cindy Chang with the LA Times, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
If you're a Catholic or a Jew, you can opt to have religious rules govern your family life here in the U.S. Let's say you want to end your marriage. You can ask for an annulment or a Jewish get in addition to filing for a legal divorce. Same goes for a Muslim. You can follow Islamic law or Sharia for certain family matters. But some lawmakers in Texas think that's a bad idea. They've proposed what amounts to anti-Sharia legislation for several years now. Even though those bills have gone nowhere, they've made Muslims in Texas feel like they're under attack. The World's Matthew Bell has a story.
Get it up and get it going.
On Texas Highway 71, roadside signs remind drivers to praise God. And on the radio dial, there's a reminder that for most folks in these parts, that would be a Christian God.
Ephesians 5, 15 and 16 tell us to walk in wisdom and redeem the time.
Evangelical Christians are a powerful political force in Texas, but the fastest growing religious group might be the Muslim population. And for some, that's a problem. Early this year, the State House in Austin hosted its 7th annual Texas Muslim Capital Day. Protesters showed up, and here's what happened when a woman in a headscarf started to speak at the podium.
We are honored. Thank you.
I proclaim the name of the Lord Jesus Christ over the capital of Texas. I stand against Islam and the false prophet Muhammad.
Inside the Capitol building, State Representative Molly White made national news when she told staff to have any Muslims visiting her office denounce terrorism and pledge allegiance to the USA. Meanwhile, conservative lawmakers proposed two bills to ban foreign laws in state courts. The authors declined to be interviewed for this story. They say the bills were not aimed at any particular religion, but Texas Tea Party activist Joanne Fleming tells me the legislation would have helped put a stop to creeping Islamic Sharia law.
We do see it creeping into communities across Texas, and so we just believe that it's important for people to understand that when you come to our country, you need to be under our rule of law. And frankly, if you don't like that, then this might not be the right place for you.
Fleming says she's particularly concerned about the impact of Sharia law on women.
As an American woman, as a citizen, I do not agree with the tenets of Sharia law. I do not want it used in our courts against any women.
Mona Kafil would probably agree with that statement. She's with the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation, based in the Dallas suburb of Plano. Kafil says religion can be a problem when it comes to men mistreating women, but that goes for all religions.
Men who need power will abuse women on basis of religion. I've heard so many stories of pastors' wives. They will quote the script. It's not just Islam, it's religion. People who need power, they will quote text.
But we're talking about Islamic Sharia law here. So I asked Kafil about the Texas imams she has dealt with over the years. There are something like 60 mosques just in the Dallas area. Should Texans worry about imams using Sharia law to subjugate women? Absolutely not, she says.
They understand the law. They understand the text. They're not misinterpreting it, the religious text, for them to be empowered. They understand those issues. They work with women to understand what the issues are and how to solve them.
Here's how that process worked for Alia Salem. She runs the Dallas-Fort Worth chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. After her husband became unfaithful and abusive, Salem says she decided she needed a divorce.
I approached my imam and I told him, I said, I'm ready. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yes. And he said, okay, complete a letter for me and address it to the court.
The court she's talking about is a religious tribunal. It helps settle personal or business matters for Muslims on a voluntary basis. Salem says the court's ruling was about finding religious meaning during a difficult time in her life.
For me, that was such a huge relief because I was religiously separated from this individual. And he had no religious rights on me, and I had no religious rights on him. This solved it for us.
Salem says the imam's intervention took about 3 weeks. Getting a legal divorce took about 6 months. Salem says these were two entirely separate things. The religious court had no legal standing, she says, though it did help move things along.
When I went to my attorney and filed for divorce in the court system, I presented this because it's a notarized document. It's a contract between two people, legal contract. And he said, this is fantastic. I can use this as supporting evidence for an uncontested divorce.
This is the kind of thing that proposed legislation might have put a stop to had it actually passed. Any reference to foreign laws in Texas family courts would have been banned. Several states have passed similar laws. But legally speaking, many experts say they don't do much of anything, and they might be unconstitutional. Bea Moorhead is with an Austin-based interfaith group called Texas Impact. She says the legal ramification of anti-Sharia legislation is not the real issue here.
Let's just say it. It's specifically intended to hurt people's feelings, to promote discrimination against one particular religious tradition. The spirit of it is anti-Muslim. That's just not something we should be engaging in the state.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Austin.
11 Americans, 11 Japanese, 90 minutes, and we think a new day for women's soccer on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Soccer involves 22 players kicking a ball, and after 90 minutes, the U.S. women's national team wins, not Germany for a change. That's what it feels like after the U.S. clobbered Japan yesterday to win a record third Women's World Cup title. The American team scored 4 goals in the first 16 minutes to secure the title. Here in the U.S., we're still celebrating, but sports writer Joanne Gerstner says, imagine what that felt like for Japan.
I can't imagine a worse nightmare that you work 4 years to get to the final and then you absolutely get blitzed. But I think Japanese soccer is in an excellent place. I mean, the Nanashiko are a very, very established, well-funded, well-respected program. I think Japanese soccer is in a very, very, very good place. And the fact that they handled themselves with class and dignity and kept fighting, I mean, they were down, but they kept fighting. That says a lot about who they are and the character of their program.
So the narrative of the U.S. women's soccer team with its wins at the U.S. World Cup has always been about what it's done for soccer in the United States. But I want you to just kind of take that apart for a second. Seriously, is there a long way to go before the women's game gets as big as even pro ice hockey?
Women's sports is still basically growing out of its infant stage. You know, Brazil, they're so horribly underfunded that the women are almost like touring like a little league soccer team. They're not treated like professional elite athletes. Last time when Japan won the World Cup, they received $1 million from FIFA for winning. This time, the U.S. women get $2 million for winning. Well, here's the problem. Germany, the men, received $35 million for winning last year.
Wow.
So that is just, it's not even in the ballpark. We're on two different planets of funding.
Are the women players insulted with prize purses like that compared to the men?
You know, I don't know if insult is the right word, but they definitely take notice. I mean, you know, like it or not, our paychecks are kind of a ratification of our status. I mean, they had $576 million of purse money last year for the men, for all the teams. This year, the entire Women's World Cup field got to divvy up $15 million. So,
wow.
You know, if my paycheck's $15 million and yours is $576 million, we're going to have a little discussion about that.
I'll say. You know, Joanne, a few weeks ago on The World, we were shocked to learn that starting salaries for women's soccer pros in the U.S. are about $15,000 a year. Now, you said that Japanese soccer, women's Japanese soccer, is pretty well funded. What does it actually look like? And what are these Japanese players who came in second place, what are they going back to?
Well, the Japanese Women's League is pretty decently strong. I don't know what the salaries are in their league, but you got to remember, a lot of times women, much like within the professional basketball circles, they cobble together a livelihood by playing in one country during one season and then going to another country for another season. So it's not like a guy, let's say, in the NFL that only plays in the NFL and that's it. So when you see a star player playing in Japan and then going over to Sweden or to France for their season, that's why they're doing it. They're basically playing in two different leagues, which obviously is harder on your body if you have to play two seasons to earn a decent paycheck. So it's hard to see, but the argument on the other side is, hey, look at how far we've come. We now have these leagues. People are coming to watch women play. You know, Nike is selling Abby Wambach and Alex Morgan jerseys, and guys are wearing them. So, you know, there is definite progress, but the rate of progress is slow. And I'm really encouraged to see people enjoying the sport for what it is. And I'm saying, hey, look, there's a bunch of girls playing soccer. Isn't that cool? Now it's like, wow, the U.S. women's team is good.
Right. So let's see what the next kind of bit of achievement is going to be. 5, 10 years down the road, when you look back at the 2015 Women's World Cup, what do you think is the most important thing you're going to be taking away from this U.S. women's victory?
I take it more than just the U.S. women's victory. Obviously, it's huge for the women's national team. You know, to win the World Cup 3 times is unbelievable. I mean, that's even on the men's side, that's respected, you know, that you went 3 times. But I think this had larger global implications because this now might mean that England, who has a beautiful and amazing soccer tradition, will now be giving their women the support they need and the respect they need and deserve. France, same thing. Hopefully Brazil got a little bit of a wake-up call with the Olympics coming down there next year, and they'll want to give their women the support. So maybe this might have been the World Cup that moved us past just the U.S. winning everything and being number one. But to the rest of the world, who is getting better and moving up close to the U.S., that the rest of the world gets their respect and treats their women's teams a little better, too.
Sports writer Joanne Gerstner, thank you so much for your time, for your thoughts.
Thank you.
And for the end of regulation time at the World today,
I'm Alejandro Murguia, and I've been accused of being a poet.
San Francisco's poet laureate, to be exact. As part of our Global Nation education coverage, we've been asking immigrants like Alejandro Murguia to tell us about their early school days in the U.S. He's from Mexico and moved with his family to the San Fernando Valley in Southern California when he was six.
It was in October. Must have been 1955, I suspect, or so. I must have been the only non-white person in the school. Totally white kids. And so there was a period where I was very silent. And it's through reading that I break out and find my place in school. By the third grade, I'm already a fairly voracious reader. And I remember my library card having like 30 books checked out that semester. And by the time I'm 15, I start scribbling in notebooks every night. Here's what would happen. I would go to the liquor store. I would buy a big bottle of RC Cola, not realizing that the caffeine was going to keep me up all night. So I'm writing this journal until I finally fall asleep at 1 o'clock or something like that. But then the next morning, I can't get up to go to school, right? So it became this endless cycle. So high school was a complete disaster for me. And then I have my art teacher, Grace Garcia, and, you know, I start showing her some of my work, and she gives me a lot of books to read, a lot of heavy stuff, right? I'm reading Sartre, No Exit, for example, and Nausea, and Candide by Voltaire. And she's sending us to museums to look at Picasso and Van Gogh and Dali. We're all in love with Dali because he's so far out and crazy and stuff. And that's probably where I first started reading poetry. She had encouraged me to take my SAT scores, and I scored really high. And so she showed up one day during that summer and takes me to Los Angeles City College and enrolls me. Because had she not done that, I had no idea of going to college. My dad always encouraged us to not work like he did. He was a laborer. And so he encouraged us to be educated, but obviously he didn't know how to go about the process, right? But, you know, he insisted that we finish high school, which we did. But after that, he had no idea how to enroll somebody in college. He had never been on a college campus. So it was kind of fortuitous that Grace Garcia sent me to college.
You can hear Alejandro Murguia read one of his poems at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios on this Monday at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. At skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.